Catholic Radio Indy now presents Faith in Action, a program that looks at how everyday people put their faith into action in their everyday lives. Our program is underwritten in part by Franciscan St. Francis Health, providing faith-based integrated health care, a recipient of HealthGrade's 2015 America's 100 Best Hospitals Award, and by Marian University, a great Catholic university dedicated to providing students with excellence in teaching and learning in the Franciscan and liberal arts tradition, preparing transformative leaders for service to the world. And now, here's today's edition of Faith in Action.
Welcome once again to Faith in Action. I'm Kent Blanford. In the studio with me today, MJ Crowder. MJ, we have our dinner coming up in the fall.
We do.
And
we
we'd
do.
Like to put out a request here early. Anyone who would happen to have something in the way of a great silent auction item, we'd love to have those in here. They're fantastic fundraising items.
They are. You know, we are looking at, now that we've finished the golf outing, I know that September is going to barrel down upon us. I know July is going to be gone before we know it, and then we're getting the kids back in school, and that's going to be gone. So time is rapidly approaching. So if you own a small business or you happen to have a service, those are always delightful. I mean, those are always wonderful. Women's jewelry, of course, is great. Craft items, pieces of artwork, bottles of wine, baskets, anything like that. But we also need the little bit bigger items, like something that we would offer in an auction, if you will, right after dinner or during dinner. Those go over hugely. The dinners that people offer to cook in your homes for six or eight people, those were a huge item last year.
Those were very big. We had quite a bit of bidding going on those.
That was
and
fun.
We even came up with one of our chefs offered to split himself.
He did.
And
he did.
Double his offer so that, you know, right there on the spot, okay, if you're bidding that and you're bidding that, I'll do you both. So, you know, we get those kinds of offers. If we get chefs, if we get floral arrangements, anything that you can think of that would make a great live or silent auction item, give us a call here at the station, 317-870-8400. That's 317-870-8400. Now, in the studio with us today, we have Sandra Meisel, and we are picking up kind of where we left off a while back. We've been doing a series on the Reformation, or in our case, we're looking at it as reformations, plural. And so far, we've covered a lot of territory. And the reason we're doing this, just as a reminder, is the fact that this October 31st marks the 500th anniversary of what is kind of a legend, but also kind of accepted as the kickoff of Reformation, when Martin Luther publicly posted his objections to what was going on in the Catholic Church.
Well, you're right. It kind of all started with that. I think it was building for a time. Welcome to Sandra Meisel, who, of course, has an incredible author. I call her our local church historian because she wrote The Da Vinci Hoax, which is a great book, I think, for kind of starters, because it kind of piqued my interest into a little bit of this, what we didn't know about the church, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so welcome, Sandra. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Mm-hmm. You know, for our listeners who haven't heard the first few segments, and we've done this about every 6 to 8 weeks, almost every 2 months, we started back in January, February with King Henry VIII, which is kind of where it all started, Martin Luther, Calvin, then women in the Reformation, and we're going to go kind of wrap it up a little bit today and talk a little bit more about it. But if you would, Sandra, just give us a little bit of a recap of what prompted the Reformation and kind of a recap up to today. So can we do, it's taken us 6 hours to get to now.
But it's only 500 years.
But it's only 500 yes. years, yes. Right.
Well, the Reformation is a period in early modern history, the early 16th century. The idea that the church needed reform had been building for at least 100 years. People, thoughtful bishops and popes had said, we really need to clean up our act. the church is corrupt, the church is putting too many burdens on people. We really need to clean this up, but nobody listened. They had church councils at which nothing happened. So when Martin Luther, who had been to Rome and had seen exactly how corrupt Rome was and had his own personal agendas with his own spiritual crises, said, we don't need Rome. We don't need endless prayers for the dead. We can simplify worship, et cetera, et cetera. He found a welcome audience. And then this spreads like wildfire throughout Germany, into Switzerland. It doesn't get into Spain because Spain had the apparatus of searching out heresy, and they snuffed out any possible heresy right away. It didn't get very far in Italy. It has been suggested that countries that went Protestant in the first wave of the Reformation did not have an adequate number of local saints.
Really?
And that devotion to your local saint was a big part of what tied you into the Catholic Church. And Germany was rather short on local saints. It may be a coincidence. So you have people like Zwingli and Calvin popping up, and it spreads into France, and it tries to spread into Poland. Poland almost became Protestant in the 16th century. This may come as a terrible shock to our Polish listeners.
Who think it fiercely Catholic.
Yes, well, for a while, the nobility liked this idea of no Rome. And the nobility was leaning Protestant, and they were re-evangelized back into the straight path, so to speak. So Henry VIII, seeing the chaos on the continent for his personal reasons about wanting a divorce when he wasn't supposed to get one, declared himself head of the church, and from this, the Anglican and Episcopal churches spring, and they are closer to Catholic doctrine, but the idea that something was wrong was pretty much general agreement. Now, let's give some credit to the people who sincerely accepted the Reformation. They didn't have to worry about the fate of their dead relatives. They didn't have to offer endless masses for the dead. They didn't have to see their contributions to their church being skimmed off by Rome, etc., etc. And there were people who became Protestant, who stayed faithfully Protestant in the face of cruel persecution. It's particularly impressive are the Anabaptist groups, who said that only adults could be baptized. And these are the forerunners, not only in an indirect way of the Baptist church we know in America, but of Mennonites and Amish and Hutterites and these other groups. They were martyred by all sides, and they stayed very faithful to their beliefs. And even though they're still in small numbers, they're pretty stubborn about their simplified basic Christianity religion. And the nobility, of course, liked the idea that we can confiscate church property.
Yeah, interesting.
This was a big motive that kept England in the Protestant side later. But then there was buyer's remorse. People who had originally embraced the Reformation, let us say your basic peasant in Germany, who sees this drunken priest who has a mistress and illegitimate children and doesn't take much care of the church, and they said, we want good pastors who will preach the pure holy gospel. And what they got by academically educated priests who are now married, who may have been Catholic priests before they turned Protestant before they married, obviously, came in and were so different in their interests and the things they thought important, the peasants could barely communicate with them. And when the seasonal times came for the blessing of the animals, and the peasants would go to the new pastor and say, well, St. Anthony's Day, let's bless the animals. That is a popish superstition. What do you mean? You want our animals to die? No, I don't want your animals to die. Well, will you please get on with the holy water and bless the animals? Well, maybe this one time. And that went on for quite a few years in Germany. In Scandinavia, the authorities had imposed, the king and the nobles had imposed a Protestant settlement on the countries of Scandinavia. And they were very anxious that everybody's going to read the Bible. So they set up schools, and they not only have schools available, you are required to go, and you have to study your catechism, and children had very little free time in those days, and to take away what free time they had for, frankly, boring catechism classes, on which they would be examined by government inspectors, it kind of turned them off religion. And we have scores and scores of records of these examinations in villages. And one of my old professors, Gerald Strauss, did a landmark book called Luther's House of Learning on the impact of this system, which rendered faith in Scandinavia rather dull. And the people might learn to read in grade school, the equivalent of grade school, but they didn't have the money for books, so they didn't keep up their reading, and they couldn't possibly afford to buy a Bible, so they aren't really literate after they forget. But they're under the thumb of the government to perform and show that you're literate. Well, this, until there was a revival of piety in the 18th century, religion in Scandinavia is pretty dull.
Now, and I do want to talk about that, by the revival of piety, which is kind of interesting, and it came much after the Reformation, of course.
Yes.
And really, the effects of the Reformation almost required the revival of piety. It was an inevitable pendulum swing back. If you're just now tuning in, listeners, Sandra Measle, our guest, the effects of the Reformation, we're talking about that, really kind of a thumbnail sketch to what brought about the Reformation and the things we've talked about, starting with King Henry VIII, Luther, Calvin. Calvin was interesting because I did not, well, okay, so you roll your eyes, interesting. I knew a little bit about Calvin, and I honestly don't know. I mean, he's not an interesting man to read about, but a curious person in our history. And I was mistakenly informed about him. I thought I knew a little bit about him. I thought I knew what branch of religion kind of came from him. You know, we concentrate a lot on Luther, you mm-hmm. know, during the Reformation. And I did learn a lot about you. It prompted me to do a little bit more research and dig up a little bit about Calvin, because in circles today, sometimes in Bible studies, Catholics will be accused of, well, that's a Calvinistic idea, you know, you're leaning towards Calvinism there, you know. And I was, well, what are they talking about? What do they mean when they say that? So I'm glad that you kind of brought that up a little bit. We need to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Welcome back to Faith in Action. Our guest today, Sandra Measle. She is our returning guest. We started, gosh, years and years ago, Sandra, had you on, I think, originally maybe for your book, for the Da Vinci Hoax. And I remember one of your parting comments was, have me back. I'd love to talk more about church history. And I thought, how interesting would that be? I mean, how interesting can church history be? Not very, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, once you start digging into it, I mean, it's very interesting to see where we came from and how the church has kind of the ebbs and tide and the pendulum swinging, if you will, back and forth. But right before the break, I was talking a little bit about Calvin, and I didn't realize that really in his own right, I mean, he and Martin Luther, although they may never have met, I mean, I think
they did meet.
They did meet.
They did meet, and shouts were heard.
I thought that they might have been
it wasn't Luther and Calvin who met. It was Luther and Zwingli. But shouts were heard.
Shouts were heard. I imagined, Kent, and I don't know how much you know about this, but I thought Calvin and Luther may have been, I imagined that they were in the same camp, and that was not true at all.
Far from it.
Yeah, I thought that they were kind of cohorts, you know, on the same side of the fence, if you will. But had a similar idea, you know, getting the Catholic Church, you know, out of the picture, or at least to the side.
That was the only thing they might have agreed upon.
That was the only thing they agreed upon. Yeah, it was very interesting.
When Calvin tried to talk to Luther, sent him a personal letter, surely we can negotiate our differences, Luther's friend and associate said, "Oh, Dr. Calvin, I cannot possibly show your letter to Dr. Martin because he will fly into a titanic rage." No, they did not like each other.
Okay. And, all right. Now, that was interesting.
They have a very different take on theology. Calvinism has more of an influence on the American Protestant spectrum than Luther does. For instance, the once saved, always saved idea that you hear from many evangelicals, that is Calvin talking. That if you're really predestined and have the grace, you are not going to sin. You're not going to ever lose your faith. Well, that unfortunately flies in the face of common experience. So let me say a few words about resistance to the Reformation. And a lot of people were completely dumbfounded. Well, what is this? You've torn out all the statues in our church. There were mobs who, and not a very large mob, maybe 100, 200 people, who roamed through the Netherlands just taking over churches and smashing everything and burning the statues and all the church fittings and then painting the inside white. And the townspeople, not in a position to resist the rioters, having no police, would be horrified, and there wasn't anything they could do about it. So there were people who did not like these things, and sometimes they were able to keep their faith by going into hiding, or maybe by changing the opinion of the local ruler. Now, some of these German states, and Germany was at that time a whole mosaic of large and small principalities. If we change the religion of the ruler, he'll tolerate the Catholic Church. And in fact, Bavaria flipped back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A time or two. And the Rhineland, which is very Catholic today, was a stronghold of Calvinistic Protestantism at one time because of the politics of the rulers. So in England, when King Henry VIII said, "I am the head of the church and you will now listen to me and not Rome, and we'll take out all these popish superstitions like statues of the saints, and we're going to not have an altar but a communion table," the local people in many cases, particularly in rural areas, hid the sacred vessels or maybe hid statues of the saints. Occasionally they find these things. Even today, they found a crucifix about maybe 10, 20 years ago that had been hidden since the Reformation. And of course, there were efforts to re-evangelize England, the famous Jesuit secret priests going into England and saying mass in country houses and hiding in priests' holes, but almost inevitably being captured and horribly executed. So the picture is very muddy, and then in the next century you have the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, where the Catholics and the Protestants had one last slanging match at each other. It was the cruelest and most horrible disaster to befall Europe between then and the First World War. One third of the people in Germany died
in this war.
And it, eventually Catholics were fighting on the Protestant side and vice versa. And after a treaty was negotiated, all sides took a deep breath and said, "Well, your religion is the religion of your ruler. And if you don't like it, move. But we're not going to fight anymore." And there is no active religious war, other than to an extent the troubles in Northern Ireland. There's no active religious war in Europe from that time until present.
Oh, that's interesting. Your religion is the religion of your ruler. Mm-hmm. If you're just now tuning in, listeners, we're getting a little tidbit, another chapter, if you will, the effects of the Reformation with Sandra Measle. We started with King Henry VIII and went all the way through, starting pretty much this year, every couple months, another little chapter on the Reformation, the effects, women in the Reformation. We're talking today a little bit about approval, resistance, and buyer's remorse. And, you know, I was talking with Father Guy Roberts, who was a Lutheran. He's at St. Joan of Arc. He's a convert. And he went through a Lutheran seminary. He was, I think he was either maybe a Methodist, born and raised rah-rah Christian, very devout Christian home, and felt called to the seminary. joined the Lutheran seminary, and was months, just within months, I think a semester before he was ordained a Lutheran minister. And it was in reading and diving into Luther and the Reformation that he learned quite deeply and quite a rich history in the Lutheran seminary, he said. It he put it on par. I mean, the Catholic seminary, he said, really rivaled quite well. I mean, the Lutheran seminary got more history. And it was after reading history, church history, and the church fathers in the Lutheran seminary that he realized that it was the Catholic Church is where he was called. And he, moments before his ordination, left the Lutheran seminary, became Catholic, and then quickly entered the Catholic seminary. So it's church history. And how many people have we had here on Faith in Action who have told us that converts, that the reason they have converted was because they read teachings and writings of the church fathers? Now, Sandra, when I say that, when I say church fathers to you, and you would nod your head, who would be those people that would come to mind when you would say, I was reading the church fathers? Because you hear that all the time, from Bishop Barron to, you know.
Well, the four major church fathers are ecclesiastical writers from the first six centuries of the church who have an enormous influence on formulating our doctrines and our beliefs and our practices. And in the West, the four major doctors are Jerome, Augustine, Gregory the Great, and Ambrose, who are all dead by 450, probably earlier than that. I think St. Augustine was the last one, and he died in 435. Well, and in the East, they have the two Gregories and John Chrysostom, and oh dear, I'm
okay,
forgetting
John
the first
Chrysostom.
One.
Yeah, but so Augustine, but, Jerome, Gregory the Great, and Ambrose.
Okay. Ambrose, right. And I didn't give them in chronological order. But there's a host of other lesser people that have either fragments left or whole books who are busily writing, and these are invoked to show that we have believed the same essential doctrines from the very beginning. And there's a nice set, Faith of the Fathers, that you can get, which is a three-volume series of excerpts from the major church fathers. And there are also many collections of the complete church fathers, some of which are not as interesting as others.
Well, you referenced a book today, which I think is kind of interesting. That's next on my list. I want to put that down. What is that?
Well, to get an overview of the Reformation, I think the best thing you can get now, if you're really serious, is Carlos Ira's Reformations. Notice the plural, because it's not one thing. It's a host of small movements that grow, and they're not in agreement with one another, just like Luther and Calvin were not in agreement with one another. So I have here, that MJ mentioned, a new book by Brad Gregory, The Unintended Reformation, and this is an examination of the long-term impact of the Reformation on European civilization. Such things as privatizing religion puts religion in a little compartment, and anybody's conscience is as good as anybody else's conscience. And now we have a situation today where nobody's conscience is as good as anybody else's conscience.
I would ask you a question, Sandra. When you said that, back in the day, your religion was the religion of the ruler.
Mm-hmm.
When did that kind of fracture or faction to the understanding that we could choose our own religion? And thereby it was mobile, if you will, like the Portable Care Act, the Portable Religious Act, if you will. When did that kind of become popular?
It's a slow and gradual process. You weren't going to be a Protestant in Catholic Spain.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Sure.
But in Germany, which was so mobile, chaotic at times, that's where some of my own ancestors come from. The town where my maternal ancestors come from in Baden, according to the encyclopedia, no Protestant services were permitted until the middle of the 19th century.
Oh my.
Whereas you go to the Duchy of Württemberg, which is now part of the other half of Baden in present-day Germany, the Duke was more tolerant, and he allowed Calvinists, Lutherans, and Catholics to coexist. And it was apparently the only place in Europe in the late 16th century where this happened, where they were not killing each other. You didn't get Catholic emancipation in England until the 1830s. The Catholics weren't being hanged, but they were still barred from a lot of civil rights.
Little reprieve. They weren't being hanged.
Yes. Oh, I mean, no, that helps. There. That helps. And Catholics didn't tolerate Protestants either. Let's put sure. that. So I'm glad that we don't kill each other today, and we do learn to appreciate the strengths of other people's religion. But to be deep in history is to be Catholic. You read church history and you realize that the Catholic Church, in its many branches, has the fullness of Christ's truth.
And that is a perfect way to end our segment today. To be deep in history is to be Catholic. And as you said, the fullness of truth, the Catholic Church does have the fullness of truth. Many of them, as Pope John Paul II, the Great, how do you say that all, Saint John Paul the Great II, in his book, Crossing the Threshold, he said that there are many religions out there and many of them have slivers of the truth.
Yes.
But the fullness of truth, of course, we know in our beautiful Catholic faith. Our guest today, Sandra Measle, our local church historian, God bless you for being our guest. Mm-hmm. And a little tidbit for the future, what might we chat about in the future? What upcoming segments might be?
Well, MJ has suggested that I do snippets on church history, and these will be snippets. If you want to learn more, I'll try and give you some reading. But I thought I would start out with how evangelization happened in the early church, how we grew into having churches as buildings, as formal parishes. And take it, the Desert Fathers, the Church and the Barbarians, other snippets from history that maybe you didn't get in school, and I hope you would find interesting.
Amen. Well, God bless you, and thank you so much for being our guest. Until the next time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Faith in Action, underwritten in part by Marian University and by Franciscan St. Francis Health. If you'd like to suggest a guest or a topic for a future program, call us at 317-870-8400 or email mj@catholicradioindy.org. And remember, you can hear or download this program or any Faith in Action program 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the Programming tab and select Podcasts.